informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Good evening and welcome to The Big Picture, a URN's flagship politics and current affairs show. Thank you for joining us this evening. We'll be discussing the Russia's intervention in the Ukraine and its military takeover in the light of recent pro-EU protests against the Ukrainian government. We'll be talking about Labour's internal reforms. It's reformed its membership. The party has voted to change it so that members are not automatically affiliated if they're a member of a union. They have to opt in themselves. We'll be discussing that. And we'll also be discussing the student union at Nottingham here and the upcoming SU elections. If you'd like to text on any of the issues we'll be discussing this evening, the number to do so is 07762 212434. Or you can send us a free web text. But first of all, let's go to our panel and meet them. So we'll start with Joe.
Hello, I'm Joe Himsworth, first year history student. And make sure you read my blog at www.notesfromayoungfogey.com.
Hello, I'm Kieran. I'm a second year politics American studies student. And make sure you listen to my radio show every Friday, 2 till 5, The Big Show with Kieran and Pete. Seb, what are you going to plug?
I'm Seb Bench. I'm a second year politics student. Now, just about to say, I'm not going to shamelessly plug anything. So there you go.
And I'm Zoe, I'm a second year politics student and I have nothing else to plug.
And I'm David, I am a third year PhD student reading criminal justice and I'm not going to sully this with cheap commercial plugs.
There we go, feelings very clear on advertising. Bit of Mad Men, Don Draper sort of thing going on here, but we'll leave that for now. So we'll start off with our first story, which is Russia and its military intervention in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has condemned what he calls the armed seizure of power in Ukraine and the removal of an elected president after Ukrainian protests for the EU, after the Ukrainian government voted to opt away from the EU. Vladimir Putin has sent in troops into Russia. They now occupy much of Crimea. He has said that they have pulled back from the Ukrainian border, but Russian troops still control some cities, airports, harbours, and have implemented roadblocks. America has issued an ultimatum saying if it is enacted, it would be, quote-unquote, a dangerous escalation of the situation, already announcing the suspension of military ties with Moscow, including planned exercises and meetings. The EU, in the meantime, has announced 11 billion euros in aid, and there has been widespread condemnation from the international community. David Cameron has said nothing is off the table when it comes to sanctions. There is a possibility of that. So what I'd like to ask the panel is Russia's intervention justified or is it an act of military aggression? Seb?
I think, no, it's not justified. Despite their attempts to try and justify and claim to defend the rights of Russian speakers in Ukraine, apart from the claims from Russia, it's been very little other evidence that such... you know, widespread atrocities are happening against them. It would seem to me to be a power grab for Russia, partly because they saw, you know, a vulnerable situation where they could get more power, but also, you know, as a punishment, they wanted Yanukovych to tilt towards Russia, and he did choose to. And when that failed due to the protests, I think Russia tried to take more power themselves. And I really think there is no legitimate justification for Russia's recent military acts here.
I mean, quite... clearly, everybody in the West is more or less in agreement that what Seb said is broadly correct. And there are a lot of Ukrainians, I think, who would agree with that. But you've got to remember that Ukraine is a deeply divided country, politically speaking, and that the majority in the Eastern Bloc and the majority in particularly the Crimean region, which was already looking at voting for independence from the Ukraine, it's already a politically autonomous region. That they are very strongly pro-Russia, that they were very strongly pro-Yanukovych, and that their disapproval for the existing government suggests that, you know, that there is an audience for Russian attempts to justify it. So whilst I think I and the other lawyers are probably likely to agree with Seb's assumption that this is an act of aggression, I mean, putting... more and more troops into the Crimea, even notwithstanding the fact that the Ukraine and Russia do have an agreement for the Russian troops to be present on the soil. The stepping up in numbers, the scale of the incursion seems to suggest that this is an act of aggression, but that's not to say that there will be nobody who thinks that it's justified and that Russia is necessarily going to be left out in the cold over this.
I think very valid points there, but I think there's actually been recent polls on this in all of the different districts, regions of Ukraine and, of course, Crimea. And no majority is actually in favour of this intrusion by Russia. So it may well be that they are in favour of the Russians. They want to maintain a strong bond with the sort of former masters, as it were. But no one in the, well, no majority in the country, apparently, actually wants this rather aggressive intervention.
What do you think is Vladimir Putin's ultimate strategy here? What's he trying to gain? Is it regional primacy, or is he what's he trying to do, Joe?
Well, I think, personally, this might be a bit hyperbolic, but I think it's a case of the Empire Strikes Back. I think that Vladimir Putin has sort of been living in the shadow of those former communist leaders. This is the man who said that Stalin was the greatest ever Russian leader. In December, to not much news at all, there was a Russian warship off the Scottish coast. And I just think he likes being the aggressor. I just think he likes being that sort of man. Me saying this doesn't mean that he's going to go and invade the rest of the Eastern Bloc. But I think that if opportunities like this arise again, where there are vacuums, he's going to go and try and fill that with his own aggression and be intrusive.
No, I completely agree. I think, you know, you're right when you describe it as a power vacuum. You're seeing a situation in which America is really starting to leave the world stage to a great extent. And I think Vladimir Putin is trying to fill that void quite aggressively with his own characteristic way of dealing militarily with the rest of the world. I don't think it's going to be extremely successful. I don't think it's going to be successful PR-wise, but I do think it's going to be successful actually in gaining it, what he wants out of it, because ultimately we live in a post-Iraq war era, and no one in the West is prepared to go after him.
I think that's true to a certain extent. I mean, when you have Angela Merkel, the great conciliator, saying that somebody basically has no grasp on reality, then you do have cause for concern, particularly when that person has their finger on a nuclear button. But I think as well, you've got to see this not just from a political perspective, not just from the position of Putin wanting to be the new leader of a Soviet Union-style government. But in that regard, I think it's also worth thinking about the fact that the Ukraine is such an important economic satellite state for Russia that it does want to try and block their ongoing relationships with the European Union. And that I think he's playing a much longer term game here, which may involve Russian interests in Syria, may involve Russian interests in Georgia and in other states around the region. So I think it is going to be quite a significant longer-term goal, and it's not just about grabbing land.
Yeah, I'd agree to an extent with what everyone said. I think there are two points. I think they're kind of both about power. One is trying to influence the new Ukrainian government to try and encourage them to seek ties with Russia, and so they not do a completely 180 back to the EU and away from Yanukovych. I think they want to assert their influence and power over that new government. But I think ultimately if that fails, it is, I said, down to a power vacuum. They see an opportunity to seize power to maybe increase Russian interests and their power. And as a result, trying to take it, and do see that perhaps it's difficult for the West to respond. I don't think it's necessarily due to a post-Iraq war era. I think any post-Cold War era potential confrontation like this in the center of Europe is problematic, and certainly even at the most neoliberal, neoconservative world policeman stage, I think any US president would be concerned about sending a major invasion in to face Russian troops, because obviously they pack a lot more kick if things do go bad than Iraq, and they generally have weapons of mass destruction, obviously, in terms of massive nuclear arsenal.
If you'd like to text in on this issue, by the way, the number to do so is 07762-212434, or you can send us a free web text. David would like to make a point as well, but I just wanted to make another point, ask another question to the panel. Do you think this is similar to the intervention in Georgia in 2008? Do you think it will be the case where sort of they go in, there won't be any further advancements after a certain point like there was in Georgia, and there'll be a sort of a swift advance afterwards, or do you think it will be a longer drawn-out process? David.
Well, I think there's a very key difference between this and Georgia, in that Georgia was intimidated, was taunted, I suppose, into shooting first. So Russia had a clear justification, at least on the letter of international law, for stepping into Georgia. But at the same time, I think there is also an issue here with how Russia sees the successor regime in the Ukraine. Again, Yanukovych is something of a very close friend to the Kremlin, obviously, but he's also someone who was in physical danger. He was fleeing for his life when he fled presumably into the Crimea. And in that regard, I think the Russian military invasion, if you like, or not invasion, incursion, is looking to solidify and protect a key ally in the region. And they do see that, you know, that they do disagree with the dominant Western trope that we tend to see in the media here, that the new government, I keep meaning to say the Tymoshenko regime, it won't be Tymoshenko for some time, but it probably will be her once the election comes to place, is not going to be free from corruption, is not going to be, you know, like as in any transitional state, there is going to be problems. But I think in Ukraine, the rot runs a lot deeper. I can still remember all of the optimism, all of the joy surrounding the Orange Revolution. And I think there's a lot of problems in Ukraine that aren't going to be solved here. And I think Russia wants to make sure that the corruption is at least in its favor.
Yes, I'd agree with that to a large extent. I think when I say that sort of the Empire Strikes Back, I'm not saying, you know, full on invasion, but I think it's a consolidation of strategic areas there. Someone mentioned previously the oil and gas feeding through Ukraine. I think really you've got to bear in mind the history. Putin, despite being very aggressive, clearly, and it's evident through this, seems to play his cards quite close to his chest a lot of the time.
Do you think that, or do you think he's just being a bit paranoid?
No, I think he's got an agenda of sorts. It may not well be a hugely aggressive, intrusive agenda, as in let's take back the Eastern Bloc. But I think he's certainly got a motive in the sense that, well, if you look to, say, when the Cold War sort of finished, as it were, post-1990, you had NATO come in and got a lot of Eastern Bloc countries to join NATO. I think that Putin, to a certain extent, still sees a dichotomy between the West and the East, as in the large country that is Russia. So I think that's certainly something to consider.
Seb, sorry, go on.
Earlier in the week, I was leaning, saying quite strongly towards the idea that this would be a longer-term thing, or in the worst-case scenario, a short, very bad thing. But recently, particularly once the ultimatum was delivered, things are very bad. And now looking slightly better, Russia seemed to pull back slightly, and again, more talks about negotiations. So if it continues down that path, and it can negotiate, Russians can pull out completely from Crimea, and the issues that they claim they go in for, such as, you know, the rights of Russian speakers in the Crimea and things that can be protected through international cooperation and over and watch from the international community, but without, you know, active involvement from Russia, then I think this can be a short thing. But there is still the part of me that, you know, thought when the ultimatum was brought that this may be a longer term thing to permanently gain more interest in Ukraine, and as some said, perhaps part of a wider strategy to try and gain a bit more influence in those.
I want to move to the Western response now, what it should be. I mean, The Guardian has reported, I think it was this week, that Britain is drawing up plans to ensure that any EU action against Russia or over Ukraine will exempt the City of London, according to secret documents from the government that were photographed at Downing Street. The document has said that, quote unquote, it should not support for now trade sanctions or close London's financial centres to Russians. It should be prepared to join other EU countries in imposing visa restrictions or travel bans on Russian officials. It should discourage any discussions, i.e. at NATO, of contingency military preparations. And it basically wants to protect British economic interests. I mean, is that right? I mean, should they sort of have a self-interested view in all of this, Kieran?
Well, I think that's where you have the crux of the problem. You have Russia with a large amount of wealth, a large amount of new wealth and oil, let's not forget, And then you have, you know, us trying to look very hard, trying to look as though we have a concerted effort to try and stop this, when actually we are really trying to do diplomacy with our hands tied behind our back. I think William Hague's mentioning that no UK official was going to go to the Paralympic Games in Sochi was met with just general derision. You know, who cares? Great. It's really not going to affect anyone, you know. So we're in this kind of catch-22 position where, if we try and make harsh choices, it's going to affect us badly. If we do nothing, we look to be kind of sitting by as a kind of invasion occurs.
So what do you think the solution should be?
That is a very good question. what is the solution?
Should it be like sanctions, or should
I
it
think
be...
it should be sanctions?
Okay,
I think it should be sanctions of what form they take. But at the same time, when you do sanctions, you've got to make sure that they don't affect badly on us as a nation, economically and so. So that's a very tricky road, I think, to go down.
Yeah, I'd agree with that to a great extent. I think it's both good and bad in a sense. I think it's good that we're pursuing our own lots of hand signals going around. I think it's good that we're sort of pursuing our own national interest. But then the flip side of that, as has been mentioned, is that it's a shame that we're actually in that position. And as has been mentioned, you know, Russians, you know, in Mayfair, in London, and in very expensive parts of the city are huge cash cows for the City of London. So I think, yeah, two sides to this coin. You know, on the one hand, you have, yes, it's good that we are, in a sense, being self-interested and looking after our own national interest. But then on the other hand, it's a shame that that national interest is in the position that it's actually in. And so we can't really act effectively if we wanted to.
You see, this is just somewhere where I disagree with Joe at a very basic level. I think this is very bad in terms of managing to get a hold of Russia, because I think the only things that are going to really affect Russia, which is essentially a kleptocracy, is to target the most powerful people in that regime through things like asset freezes, which is exactly the sort of thing which is going to impact on the City of London. I mean, one thing you've got to bear in mind with more general trade sanctions, firstly, is that they'll rile up a lot of popular pressure from the Russian people against the Western reaction, because it will be targeting them rather than the people who are actually going to be making an effect. But also it'll be a case of brinkmanship to a certain extent with the economics. Russia's financial state is quite bad at the moment. I mean, the ruble took a tumble with the incursion, but it has been doing bad for a very long time now. And so a prolonged period of trade sanctions would do them quite serious economic harm in the long run. But at the same time, they control a lot of the oil and gas reserves for the European Union. So they can just turn that off and say, your move, creep, you know. I think the very real issue is what China's going to do about this whole situation. But I think perhaps we'll leave that for another question.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't surprise me to see that the City of London officials are questioning about the City of London being hurt by any sanctions. As Joe mentioned, there's an awful lot of Russian money in the City of London. Whether it's right, I'm not sure. It depends on the extent to which I think those sanctions would help. I think, as David said, the ruble isn't in a good place, so maybe they have a significant effect. But I fail to see, although some sanctions, particularly if targeted, may be worthwhile, I fail to see sanctions being the ultimate question of having too great an impact, particularly because Russia and their influence with gas. I think ultimately it is going to be almost pure diplomacy and the kind of slightly improvement in relations in terms of since the ultimatum recently, and hopefully instead of things like boycotting the Sochi G8, by the time things will have warmed up and improved, and at that stage really a diplomacy and talking will be the thing to solve it. But if not, I think sanctions almost as a sign of condemnation would be perhaps the best thing to do.
Okay, Joe, final point on this.
Yes, very briefly, just in sort of response to David, very briefly, I think when I mention national interest, I think that it's good on a very general point that we're pursuing that. But I do, as I think you suggest, think it's a shame that we don't actually sort of take an ethical stance over just pure capitalism. And anyway, that's sort of part of a larger debate where we seem as a country, or our governing elite seem as a country, to want to keep the City of London as positively pure, laissez-free as feasibly possible, which isn't necessary, but that's part of a larger debate.
Hello and welcome back to The Big Picture. Next up, we'll be discussing Labour's membership reforms. If you'd like to text in on this issue, the number to do so is 07762 212 434. I say it in my sleep now. We'll be discussing Labour, the good old Labour Party. Proposals to change the link between Labour and the unions have been approved at a conference, a special conference of party members by an overwhelming majority of 86% in favour. Leader Ed Miliband has urged a one-member, one-vote system for leadership elections and an end to the automatic affiliation of union members when they become a union member, so they now have to opt in to be affiliated to the Labour Party. Unite boss Len McCluskey said union members would rise to the challenge, and Conservative Party chairman Grant Shapps dismissed Labour's reforms, insisting that the balance of power remained with the unions, and he said Ed Miliband is left with a situation where the unions are now his political support machine. So, my first question, how significant are these reforms to the historic relationship between Labour and the unions? Will they signal a radical departure from this relationship, or will not very much change? Who would like to come in? Seb?
I think these are significant reforms. I mean, over the course of the last couple of Labour leaders, there have been various important changes with Labour, both think with the unions and the left of Labour as a whole. I mean, famously, Neil Kinnock struggled for years to do it, and Tony Blair and Clause 4, although Clause 4 actually was never actually interpreted in Labour policy at all, ever. It was seen as a great symbolic move for New Labour. And so I think it is significant. And I think it's the right thing to do. I think it makes the party far more democratic internally. And it may help if Labour's union members actually want to opt in, they'll be actively involved. I think there'll be a cost, both economically and perhaps in membership short term, but ultimately it's right. And I think the reason Grant Shapps is saying comments which are slightly nonsensical given the change of it, that they've been moving away from the unions, is because the Conservatives will no longer have the stick to being, oh, you're too tied to the unions, that they use so effectively on Ed Miliband, which they won't be able to use for future Labour leaders.
I think the unions will still have a large amount of power. I think a lot of what Ed Miliband's been saying and John Prescott has been saying is purely symbolic, in that they're trying to move away from the unions, because the unions will still have 50% of the vote at Labour Party conferences. There's still no cap on donations from the unions. And a lot of these policies have been phased in 5 years or more. And I think Len McCluskey at the conference said, this is our party and we're going nowhere. And that's a very sort of, it's quite a threatening statement to make when you're sort of, you know, he's been sort of backed into a corner. And I think coming out saying, this is our party, you can still see that he doesn't intend on sort of just stepping down lightly. So I think perhaps, I think the policies are more symbolic than they're actually going to have that much effect.
I mean, Len McCluskey has said he suspects about 10% of its 1 million members affiliated to Labour would opt in to stay if asked now. Do you think that's significant?
Sorry, what?
Switched off. Only 10% of its 1 million members from Unite, Len McCluskey estimates only 10% would now opt in. Isn't that a big change?
Well, I guess that's quite a big change. I think it's ironic that it's Ed Miliband who's bringing these changes around, because obviously, you know, everyone knows that it was the members that voted him in. So it's kind of as if he's, the people bring him in and he's just kind of slapping them around the face. So I guess it is quite significant, but at the same time, we can still see that unions will have a lot of power regardless.
No, I completely agree. I think there's a lot of symbolism behind it, and on paper it sounds like a very, very interesting idea. But as Zoe says, you know, you do have a case in which unlimited funding can still come from unions, and they'll have 50% of the vote. So the idea that somehow you're having a complete overhaul of the relationship between the party and the unions is I think flawed. And you do need an overhaul of that relationship, because it's too easy a stick for the party to be beaten with, you know, constantly. The only silver lining in this, of course, is that actually Tony Blair has come forward to offer to fill some of the funding gap. And of course, if that means a change of policy back to the centre, I'm all for that.
Let's keep dirty war criminals' money out of the situation. But and I think, you know, if the and one of the reasons everyone is right is undoubtedly the case why these reforms are coming through is that it's become such a whipping thing for the unions to be the representative, to be the backers. I don't think Tony Blair coming back in is going to win them any brownie points in Middle England. Having said that, I've always been surprised since about 1997 that the unions have stuck so far with the labour movement as it's progressively phased out its traditional social democratic interests in favour of an increasingly middle class chasing neoliberal move. So it's very interesting in that regard. That Ed Miliband, amongst all of these quote-unquote shifts to the left, which are not happening, is coming forward with this. And I think, yeah, ultimately this is a good thing. It's ultimately potentially going to be a very big thing. And I think it's going to make the task now for Miliband to convince the unions that it's actually worth sticking with the Labour Party, that it's not worth actually trying to chase some sort of genuinely left-wing Labour-oriented movement.
I think it is a very good idea. I'd agree with other people in saying that it seems more than anything else to be rather symbolic, and it's the sort of democratic principle that I think is particularly good in this. I think it's not really much of a shift, though. I'd say more of a realignment between both the party and the unions. I think with regards to, you know, why haven't they left, I don't think they've got that much choice, really. I mean, who else can they go to? Everyone likes a horse in a race, and I think the unions will stick by the Labour Party, sort of whether this happens or not, but I think it's good that it has happened, purely, really, more than anything else, for the symbolic democratic reasons.
Zoe?
Yeah, my feeling is mainly that this is a PR stunt as such that will be going on for a while because, election is obviously coming up next year and they're essentially trying to take out the Conservatives' ammo that they have against them, that, you know, you're controlled by the unions and everything. We can see Grant Shapps, that's his name? Yeah. It's been very dismissive about how far these reforms are actually going to go and saying that actually the unions will still have plenty of power. And
Zoe's making hand gestures. I would tend to think that what we also have to bear in mind is that the unions, to a certain extent, have to accept a reduction in their in their power as damage limitation over the scandal of alleged corruption in the election of Labour. Is it Faslane or Falkirk? I can't remember.
Falkirk.
So I think that we also have to take that into account, that there's an instrumental reason here. It's not just symbolism. It's not just that. There is legitimate damage limitation going on here.
Zoe, very quickly.
Sorry, I remembered what I was going to say, and hopefully I'll be able to finish the sentence
worries,
now.
No worries.
It was interesting to note that I read the BBC article, and the way that they reported it was that actually the union members were in favour of these reforms. It was more the sort of the party members who were actually opposed to it because they felt that it would sort of stifle their rights more for their votes. So I think that's interesting, which it sort of hasn't really come about. Everyone saying that it's going to sort of slightly hamper the unions, but actually the unions are all for it. So surely it's not going to have that much of an effect on them.
What I want to ask now is basically, is this going to appeal to the electorate? Do you think people actually think, wow, look at the Labour Party, it's trying to reform itself? Or do you think that internal party politics, do they not really interest voters very much? How do you think this is going to play with them? Seb?
I think it'll have a limited effect in terms of interest. I think, as we said, the beating, you know, people with the sticks in are too close to the unions, it'll stop that. I think really the more significant point will be, you know, the effect on policy with the potential reduction in a union vote. So that go very quickly back to the Len McCluskey quote you said earlier, which is like, it's our party, we're not leaving. I think the question is whether this does this help it become the party of the union members and less of the party of the union bosses? Because I think quite often there has been a dichotomy between those two. And I think Sunny trying to shift away from the union bosses, and we'll see, depending on how big the involvement is between union members who do opt in, we may see a different kind of union interest in Labour.
I think as well, we've broadly seen the battle lines drawn for the next election. You've got cost of living crisis on one hand, and you've got long-term economic recovery on the other. And I think this is just small potatoes, so I just don't think anyone's really going to care come May 2015. I mean, the party election propaganda machines will be in full effect, and I mean that in the most neutral sense of the term propaganda, by the way. But, yeah, it's just not going to be on the table. It's useful to the extent, as Seb says, that it denies ammunition to the opposition, but I don't think it's going to be any sort of game changer.
I'd agree to an extent. I don't think it's going to completely revolutionise the way the party acts, but I think for some voters, it will matter. I think when you ask the question, Matt, about sort of internal, external party politics, I think those boundaries are really quite blurry. And I think to a lot of people who vote Labour, you know, those internal party matters as to who gets elected are also external, because they're going to have an impact on who the leader is, what policies, you know, perhaps come out. So I do think it's important, but I don't think it's as big a deal as some people have let on. And I think more than anything else, it's really symbolic more than anything else.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have a greater effect on the electorate as they're hoping it will, because, I mean, as we've already mentioned, you know, actually, it is not this major overhaul that it's actually being made out to be when it comes to voting aspects and when it comes to funding aspects. And I think, you know, the general narrative that you get when it comes to Labour and the unions is, look, they're still in the hands of the pocket, Unite bosses or whatever. And so I think what you'll find is you'll find a situation, whether it be a year, 2 years, 4 years, but it will happen, where actually there will be a union scandal of some sort, and actually you'll end up in the same situation where we were with Falkirk or with Golden Brown, and when the British Airways strikers, where actually they will find the connection between the two still, and you'll get that old image of Red Ed and, you know, trade unionists running the Labour Party. And I don't really think it's going to have that much of an impact on the electorate when it comes to 2015.
Essentially, to sort of rephrase what everyone has sort of summed up at the table, it's quite a long thought process. You know, if I was a Labour voter, I wouldn't think, oh, well, I'll vote for Labour. Oh, wait, the unions have quite a powerful hold over them. Oh, they might have an impact on the person who, if they drop out as leader, might then elect the next one. You know, you vote for a prime minister, and at the moment it's Ed, Nick and Dave, you seem to be the choices, sorry, and maybe Nigel, maybe. but I don't think you don't elect a party with the idea that that person might then step down and one other sort of union bloc might have more sway in the vote of who's to elect them.
I think it's very telling in a way that this isn't a bigger story for Labour voters, for traditional Labour voters, because I think that the traditional link between the unions and the Labour Party, the Conservative Party likes to go on about how much this is, you know, undemocratic and problematic and all those problems. But actually, I think that there was something genuinely interesting with this being the party of Labour, this being the party that opposed capital. And whilst, you know, the Cold War sort of put paid to those broader socialist views getting explicit coverage, I think it is telling that a lot of core Labour voters just aren't broken up about this, because even if it is only symbolic, even if it is only minor, it's a step away from what Labour used to be. And it's a step that is only going to increase people like me on the left saying, we don't have a mainstream party anymore.
We're going to have to leave it there for now, I'm afraid. Time is against us. If you'd like to text in on our final story, we'll be discussing the SU and the SU elections next. All involves us. The number to do so is 07762 212434. Welcome back to The Big Picture. We'll be talking about the student union and the SU elections coming up. If you'd like to text in, it's 07762 212434, or send us a free web text. Zoe would like to do a quick plug for the Pulse on this, so I'll hand it over to Zoe.
Just quickly before we dive into a massive debate, which will be thrilling, I'm sure, I just wanted to say that the Pulse, which runs 5 till 6 on Monday through till Friday, will be, half the show will be dedicated towards election coverage. So if anyone is interested, we will be having all the various candidates on, and we will be grilling them on their policies, on their manifestos. Last year, I'm not sure if it was quite a game-changing point in the presidential campaign, but we definitely tried to hold them accountable to what they were saying, and sort of It's all very interesting stuff. And also, we run the election show next, I believe it's next Friday, isn't it?
Have a show next week.
Yeah, not this one coming up. Next Friday, the 14th of March, the URN will be running all the election coverage, and it's instant, unlike Nuts and Impact, because they have to write and film, whereas we get it out to you straight away, so listen in.
Perfect. Thank you, Zoe. Right, okay, so I mean, I want to ask the panel, I mean, what do you think of the student union? How effective do you think it is at representing students' lives? Are you excited about the elections? Do you have any preferences for candidates? Or what do you think about student issues and what's on the agenda?
I think the student union is very, very important. And last year we broke the record, I believe, in the number of people who voted. A third of students voted, which I just think is fantastic. And I think it would be a shame that if that momentum had been lost. But it, frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if it was. I have not seen any evidence of sort of SU sort of officers at the moment having any impact. And I think, you know, I'm sure they do hard work, but I think as students, we'd quite like to sort of not necessarily know what goes on behind the scenes, but maybe see, like, you know, we said that we promised that we'd do this for you, and we've succeeded in doing this, this and this. I think that'd be really helpful in kind of countering student apathy.
I never mentioned this, but I've actually been at the University of Nottingham for quite a long time now. I don't know if you know, but it's like my seventh year at URN. So, I've been seeing the SU elections for quite some time, and my immediate instinct is to say, you know, nothing ever changes. But actually, if I think back, I think in the longer term, the SU does make a real difference. I mean, if you look at the 34 bus as it really existed, obviously, for years and years, we had this staple go-to that we're going to get a hopper bus to Lenton, and it's going to be free for students, and it's going to be all of that complete and utter gobbledygook nonsense. But it just perpetuated for years on years. But what it did do was it increased the frequency of the 34 bus, it increased the availability and instituted the availability of the £1 ticket with a student card. So just in that one instance, the SU can make a big issue. I mean, over the course of my time, they've instituted Unipol, for instance. They've made great strides with helping students with accommodation. So I think there is an opportunity there. But at the same time, I think you've also got to recognize that the SU means different things to different students. I've been a postgraduate student here for longer than I've been an undergraduate now. And I have to say, the SU does normally ignore us more often than not. And the feeling's usually mutual, to be fair. Postgraduates don't tend to care that much because they're only here for like 1 year. But it does depend who you are in terms of how that question will be answered.
No, I think when it comes to sweeping policy changes and, you know, proving that you have implemented every single one of your policy, you know, promises, I'm not sure how effective the SU is on that. I'm not sure about, I don't know whether it's a communication thing or it's just that they fail. I know that Amos, the second to last president, was very proud of the fact that he managed to, I think, get through all but one of his policy promises in his, but most people wouldn't know that because I don't think that was communicated. I think when it comes to genuinely supporting and helping students, I think the SU does a very good job. When it comes to, as David said, housing, when it comes to health issues, mental health issues, when it comes to all those things that you may find yourself needing at some point within your university life, I think the student union does a very good job. My issue is that this year in particular, I don't think that there's been a great deal of communication between the SU and especially the president, who is
Ellie Williams.
Ellie Williams or something like that. I think compared to, I mean, Amos was the first was the first president I remember here, and maybe it was because I was on JCR. He seemed to be a very, very visible presence. I have not felt that from this future president, from this president. I think in the future, I think there are some great candidates this year. Are we allowed to say who we think we can,
go? No, I don't think so.
Can't do that. There are some great candidates. There are some crap candidates. But I think, you know, I think it's going to be a good year for the
elections. So they need to promote the itself more, basically.
You need to promote what you're doing, policy, and whether you're successful in that. Otherwise, people just think it's just some, you know, bureaucrat somewhere in the middle of Nottingham.
Right, Joe.
Well, I'd absolutely agree with that. Bear in mind that I'm the only first-year student on the panel. And to me, it's just sort of completely over my head. I think if you ask both myself and all of my sort of first-year chums, they won't have a clue about what's going on, really. They won't have a clue about who's standing. And I absolutely agree with what's been said previously, that there seems to be a sort of communication problem. I mean, clearly you don't want it in your face so much, but it would be nice to know. Then again, you know, perhaps I'm pig ignorant, I don't know, and maybe being in second and third years, there's a sort of point of contrast perhaps, and you've been able to become more engrossed in student life than I have in my, what will it be, 4 or 5 months. But certainly from a first year perspective, there doesn't seem to be nearly enough communication and sort of transparency with what's actually going on in the union. I think it's a bit dire, really.
I think the big theme that's coming out here is lack of communication, where I think we all understand and appreciate that the SU does a lot for us. And I think, Kieran, like you say, that they do make great strides within certain areas. But I would personally wouldn't be able to name them. And OK, it probably sounds quite sort of smug and self-congratulatory if they were to send, you know, a monthly email around being like, so students, we did this for you this month. And I think people might get annoyed with that. But at the same time, I think I personally want to know what's going on. I've been doing URN for a year and a half now. So in my first year I was on the Pulse, and Sian Green was a communities officer, and I knew her because she used to come on the Pulse regularly, maybe like once every 3 weeks or so, and she would discuss student issues that were going on. We'd just dedicate 10 minutes of the show to discussing what was going on in Lenton, etc., etc. And a lot of it went over my head because I was living in halls, but she was a visible presence for me, and I could name her on the panel of the SU. I couldn't name, apart from Ellie, I don't think I could name anyone else, and I think a lot of students would agree with me with that.
I mean, in terms of communication, twas ever thus. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I have been at the university for going on 8 years now. I'm not going to start every comment like this, I promise. But, I mean, just in terms of getting people to SU Council, I think would be a good start. I think it's phenomenally cliquey who goes to there. I mean, if you follow certain members of this panel's regulars online presence, they're always lambasting SU Council for what they do. In 8 years, I have never known where it is, when it is, what happens. And I think that's a major stumbling block for direct day-to-day democracy after the pomp and circumstance and silly costumes of the SU elections have gone past. The only other thing I'd say is I think it's interesting, though, to compare Kieran's comment about the personality politics, if you like, of Amos with the current incumbent. I don't know necessarily that you always want a flashy, in-your-face leader.
Oh, I do.
Well, there you go, you're a Blairite. But dadum tish. My point is, it's also telling that we're now in the period where it's the first year where we haven't really had a key direct elected democracy and communications officer. I always thought that was a huge misstep on the part of the students' union, because when you make democracy and communications everybody's job, it's nobody's job.
I just want to pick up on the point you made about actually elections and there being a problem with...
He's pointing to Joe.
To Joe, yes. The point Joe made about elections and not being actually been feeling there was a failure of communication within the election period itself. I have to say I completely disagree with that point. I think that's when the candidates are most visible and it's almost hard to ignore them to the point of annoyance. You walk past Horwood, you walk through Portland, you go out on a night out, they are there. They are the most visible people around. And so I think the argument that you and your chums in Hawes somehow find the whole experience alien is very confusing, considering that when I was in Hawes I was probably more engaged in the SU elections than I have. Remember that the elections don't actually open until tomorrow, right? So campaigning doesn't start proper till tomorrow.
Yep.
The idea that people are unable to engage with the elections is very odd to me. I think that's when you're most engaged with SU politics.
Joe, would you like to respond?
Well, you know, that's all well and good, but I'm just stating fact that from the people I speak to throughout campus, there just doesn't seem to be a sense of transparency, really, and communication. And I did mention in my sort of opening statement, as it were, that, you know, perhaps it's a point of contrast. Things change each year. And, you know, maybe as second, third year, however many years, David, students, you know, you have a point of contrast in, you know, comparing one year to another. But certainly for me in my first year, and I know a lot of other people in their first years, for them, things could be better. Maybe in past years, they were better, as you seem to indicate. But this year, you know, for first-year students, a significant step to university, there, from my perspective, doesn't seem to be enough.
We've got a text in, someone saying, the SU Council, what even is it? A case in point. Zoe.
I'd just like to quickly pick up on a point that Kieran made about elections starting tomorrow, which is when campaigning can actually start. Actually, the campaigning has been... Normally, they have a two-week period before... in which they can campaign, and to do so before then is technically illegal according to sort of the university rules, as it were. I don't know what they punish people with, but this year that's been scrapped, so actually people have been able to campaign for the past 2 weeks if they so desired. So I think a lot of people were kind of like, oh, it's the SU elections next week, because literally it's just kind of, it feels like it's snuck up on us and no one seems to have made a concerted effort. And frankly, if we're going to be electing these people to our SU and they've had the ability to campaign but have kind of chosen not to, I don't know, maybe they're not bothered, then I think that's quite disappointing, really.
Seb.
To build on what many people have said, kind of in the opening statements, I like many other people, fairly apathetic towards it. I mean, I will look through the manifestos and try and make an informed decision, but there's little passion on me to really, you know, feel it. But as the conversation went on, you know, there's things you do. Even I was thinking, you know, yeah, the things that the student union does that I don't necessarily associate with them. I don't think, oh, yeah, the SU does that. And so they do more than we think. And so it is. And suddenly when they're saying the long-term things that happened, which as only a second year, you don't have any concept really of how long they've been around. It is key they do have a lot to do, but as I said, there's hasn't been the direct feeling that there's certainly this year that there's been an awful lot of things. This is what USU is doing, but I think certainly, as people have said, it is very important. And even if you said they hadn't been campaigning quite as actively and as constantly as they have been in previous years, I would still, you know, encourage everyone to go and look at their manifestos online, and as many people as possible to make an informed decision and vote, because it does matter.
So what do you think the SU can do to actually promote it more, to communicate better? Do you think it's through social media? Do you think it's through things like going to lectures and talking to people there and giving them information on when councils meet and there are meetings and things, Zoe?
Well, I'd like to sort of point out two anomalies from the previous year and this year's elections. You're talking about sort of communication. How can they communicate with people? At the moment, we do not have a part-time disabled officer because the person who was in the position struggled. I think it was a girl, so I think she struggled with her work, the workload, and trying to fill this position. I had no idea that position hadn't been filled, and there was no sort of campaign, as it were. So the position is essentially empty. No one is representing the disabled network, and they opened it up to a by-election. No one ran, and so it's just going to remain that way until the next election. And I think that's wrong, and for none of us to hear about that. I mean, you know, we often get emails from all the teachers, tutors, and it's quite clear that it's very easy to make an en masse email. And I think maybe the SU could communicate with us more through email.
To be fair, in that specific example, if I can just jump in, I would expect, looking around the table, that none of us would be routinely getting emails from the disabilities officer and things like that anyway. So in that particular case, it might be a problem specific to that sub-email group, if you like, to the specific disabled community, rather than to students as a whole. But I take your point.
I think when it comes to communicating your message to students, I think the issue for us as a campus is the fact that actually you've got such a vast student population, and the actual resources that you have as a presidential candidate are quite small. And so you're trying to reach this mass population, and I really think at the end of the day you're only going to be able to reach around and really connect with around 300-400 people, 150 of who are probably your friends in the first place. There is a genuine need, I think, to create a forum in which everybody can participate and come and see the SU presidents being questioned and held to account, whether that's through here on URN. But I think there needs to be a mass debate that covers impact, that covers nuts, that covers URN, that covers every aspect of the SU, which is trying to get as many people to watch online or listen on the radio and say, these are the people that are standing for you, because you cannot engage with that whole electorate. And that's not an issue, that's not something to complain about the presidents, that's just the nature of the system. But we need, as a university, to rectify that problem.
Clearly there are logistical problems, and that's going to remain so, but do they have sort of debates?
They do. You can't fit 20,000 people in one level.
Evidently, again, logistical problems. But I think, you know, try as much as you can. Come into lecture halls and speak to people. You know, I don't know, put posters up. I don't know, but just sort of get in contact and sort of, in a sense, barrage people, but, you know, without annoying them. But certainly some sort of more visible contact with people.
Bring back Demcoms, simple as.
Right, so I'd like to say a few words before we close up this evening.
Just quickly, I've been briefed a fair bit on the elections, and there's another sort of anomaly this year in that if you didn't pull out of the election within a certain time, your name will still appear on the ballot paper. So just for people who are voting, make sure the person that you vote for is still running. If you vote for them, you obviously vote 1, 2, 3, 4, so your vote will be transferred automatically to the second person that you vote for. But there are a few candidates on the ballot paper who are not actually running anymore.
Right, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for listening to the show. We're going to have to leave it. We'll see you the week after next. Next week, this time, from 5 till 6, will be the election show. Do go out and vote. It is very important.